This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Well, now I feel a little bit better. Gee, nothing like some traditional Sanam dance music of the Uyghurs of Xinjiang to make me feel better and make me forget all about my flat tire on my bicycle and my mass transit woes and getting here into the studio by the very proverbial skin of my teeth. Well, as promised from last week, so we all know the saga. When I was looking for music of the Uyghurs, I couldn't find any, so I had to settle for Mongol and Buryat music. And then last week, when I was looking for music of the Abkhaz, I couldn't find any, but found some Uyghur music. So I brought it, and maybe one of these weeks I'll even find some Abkhaz music. So once again, that was a traditional Sanam dance style of the Uyghurs of Central Asia from the two-disc album entitled The Silk Road, which is a compilation of artists from throughout Central Asia, put out by, I'm pretty sure that it was put out by Smithsonian Folkways a couple of years ago. Let me see if I can find the information online here. Let's see. Smithsonian Folklife Festival, The Silk Road, Connecting Cultures. Yeah, this must be it. This must be it. Here we go. Yeah, right. So they've got music from, we've delved into this before. We've delved into this compilation before, but we're delving into it again tonight because we're going to continue our discussion of the politics of the contemporary great game. and the struggles for ethnic and cultural survival of the captive nations, as they have been termed, of Central Asia, and how, unfortunately, their struggles for self-determination have been manipulated into the camp of rival great powers, and how this continues to the very day. But given that I'm still combobulating myself here, maybe we should hear some more Uyghur music. Here, let's see. That was from the first disc, and I'm looking for more information about it. It just says that it's a sanam, which is a traditional dance. Maybe I can get some more information about the songs on the second disc. So let's see. I believe that would be cut 23. Yes, let's hear cut 23.
Allah. sevdayı perişan getirir.
All right, so I actually did find the liner notes online, because unfortunately that's the only way I have access to them in my rather jury-rigged and arcane system of keeping track of the music in my collection. So let's see, the name of the album is, in fact, The Silk Road, A Musical Caravan, indeed put out by the Smithsonian Institution in 2001. And the liner notes read, what if Marco Polo had owned a tape recorder? And what if his epic travels along the Silk Road had taken place not at the far end of the 13th century, not at the end of the 13th century, but at the beginning of the 21st? Far-fetched conjectures, to be sure, but in our compilation, The Silk Road, A Musical Caravan, we offer a glimpse of the rich musical life of an intrepid and curious traveler like Marco Polo might find in the lands of the Silk Road today, and the music that it features stretches all the way from the Caucasus and Turkey all the way to Korea and Japan. And the cut that we just heard there was entitled Chabiatazi Margul by the Uyghur Mukam Ensemble, recorded in Hong Kong, where presumably there is a Uyghur diaspora community. And clearly the mukam must be a variant on the makams, which we are familiar with, which are the classical motifs of Arab music. And the liner notes read, the Uyghur Oniki Mukam is a monumental musical repertoire consisting of 12 suites or mukams whose individual movements total some 360 distinct compositions. A margul is the instrumental double of a vocal piece. It follows the same rhythm, but at a much faster tempo and in a lighter spirit, with frequent modulations. This margul is the first in a series of such pieces in Mukam Chabiyat. The performance reflects a new trend towards larger ensembles with themes and motives dispersed among several instruments. Okay, sure. Well, let's see. That was, I'm not quite sure I understood all of that, but that's what it says. And those were, I'm looking for the third. This is actually a double CD. And those were two cuts from the Uyghurs. Should we hear the third? Or should I save it for later? Well, maybe we'll delve into some Uzbek music later, and you'll see that it's actually fairly similar, except I would say that the Persian influence is stronger in the Uzbek music, although they're both clearly very Persian-influenced. Yeah, why don't we hear Cut 20, which is the last Uyghur piece in this compilation.
Жакшылык кимге да кылгансың, биз эмес чыны кара жер абайдын бич алгансың, пайгамбардын алгансың, эги бир ойлоп карасам ушул бир дүйнөдө жалгансың. Илалла, Мухаммед Алла, Суралла, Кудайым өзүң бир сактай. Амманастың алгансың, а кара жер өзүң балбансың, токтогулдуң алгансың. Тоголок жерим балбансың, жеңи жоктуң алгансың, а жеренен өзүң балбансың, болдолорун чын айтат ушул бир дүйнөдөй жалгансың. Илалла, Мухаммед Алла, Суралла, Кудайым өзүң бир сактай.
иш түшүбө калар, карылык бизди жеп салар, карып калган кезинде да келин кыз кайдан кет салар, ойноп алган жаш чакта да баягы жигит деп калар, этеги жок жеңи жок энсиз көйнөк киербиз, эшиги жок төрү жок караңгы жерге да кирербиз, ойноп алган жаш чакта өлгөндөн кийин той бекербиз. Allah Muhammed Allah sur Allah Kudayım özün bir saktaydı Ötüp getse kokusta da gelin öyde sultan boy Yatıp kalasın alıp koy bulup bizge gerken de Kurt kumur sacılarlar katkırıksalar doy kubanır Allah Muhammed Allah sur Allah Kudayım özün bir saktaydı
All right, there you have it. Promise kept. Uyghur music. Okay. What is this? Okay, well, we actually did hear some of the Uzbek music, too, because it was on continuous play, and once it started, I couldn't bear to turn it down because it sounded so good. Okay, first, that was the last of the three Uyghur cuts on the album The Silk Road, a Musical Caravan from the Smithsonian Institution, 2001, and that was... called Woy Bala, which means, hey, kid, in Uyghur, performed by Nur Muhammad Tursun in Urumqi, which is the capital of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Area in China. And on this track, Uyghur musician Nur Muhammad Tursun plays the bowed sitar, which has from 10 to 12 sympathetic strings tuned to reinforce the resonance of a particular mode. Okay. And immediately after that, we heard Meskin 2 by Abdur Rahim Hamidov and Shorhat Razkov, performed in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. And the notes read, "The Uzbeks highly respect the master-disciple relationship. The master, they say, is more important than one's own father. The idea is sometimes reflected in musical forms. In Meskin 2, a variant of traditional melody from the Fergana area of Uzbekistan, Abdur Rahim Hamidov plays the dutar, a two-stringed lute, in perfect unison with the tambour, a bronze-stringed, long-necked lute played by his close disciple Shorhat Razakov. The subtle ornamentations are mirrored on both instruments, plucked with a metal plectrum on the tambour and strummed on the dutar." Okay, I'll buy that. Okay, so that was from the Fergana Valley, which lies immediately across the Tian Shan Mountains from Xinjiang or Uyghurstan or East Turkestan. And the Fergana Valley is actually, it's the one extremely fertile valley in a vast stretch of very, very arid land in stretching in every direction. And as a result, it was carved up into pieces by the Soviet bureaucrats. And each of the today post-Soviet republics of, it would be Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, I believe, have each got a little piece of the Fergana Valley. But the Uyghurs are immediately across the Tian Shan Mountains from there. And so they didn't get a piece of the valley. They were not in the Soviet Union. They were and remain in the People's Republic of China. And during the breakdown of centralized Chinese rule with the fall of the Manchu dynasty, there were various small, well, in comparison to the People's Republic of China, small, but in terms of population, probably rather small, but in terms of area, quite large, because these are very large expanses of mostly desert, very sparsely populated, traditionally inhabited by semi-nomadic herdsmen. So comparatively small, autonomous republics, some of which were loyal to the Soviets and then later to the Chinese communists, some of which were loyal to the Kuomintang, and some of which were controlled by various warlords. Those warlords in turn were either playing ball with the Japanese or the British, and it was a very confusing period there for a while. But there was certainly a push for, in spite of all of the meddling by the outside powers, for an autonomous Uyghur self-government and self-rule in the region, which was unfortunately manipulated by the various warring factions. And of course, ultimately, it was the Chinese communists who very decisively won out in 1949 and reestablished Chinese control of Uyghurstan. And then the big significant push for self-rule, whether it is separatism or autonomy, came with the fall of the Soviet Union. And of course, immediately across the Tian Shan Mountains, Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan all became independent, and there was a big push for an independent Uyghurstan as well. And that was when you had the emergence of the contemporary Uyghur independence movement, which continues to this day. And, you know, the Uyghurs were actually in the, they were actually in the news this week, although, you wouldn't know because it didn't get too much attention unless you're somebody who pays very close attention indeed to this sort of thing. But, there was actually, here, can I find it on my website? Here we go. You can read along with me at home by going to WorldWar4Report.com. Federal court denies transfer for Uyghur Gitmo detainees. Once again, a judge in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia last week denied a request made by six ethnic Uyghur Guantanamo detainees to be transferred to less restrictive facilities within the base. The petitioners argued that their solitary confinement in a higher security section of the base caused them mental suffering, but the court ruled that the detainees did not sufficiently demonstrate that they would suffer irreparable harm if they were not moved. That was a defeat. Guantanamo Bay currently houses 17 other Uyghur, quote-unquote, enemy combatants who have been cleared for transfer out of the facility. In 2006, lawyers for several Chinese detainees still held at Guantanamo Bay, most of them Uyghurs, I would imagine, meaning Chinese nationals, not ethnic Han Chinese, filed suit in U.S. federal court seeking their release due to alleged flaws in the process by which they were deemed enemy combatants, quote-unquote. The group of seven ethnic Uyghurs were deemed enemy combatants by Guantanamo's Combatant Status Review Tribunals, the CSRTs, while five other Uyghurs were cleared and subsequently released from Guantanamo Bay. Those are the ones who wound up in Albania because they did not want to be deported to China, and their attorneys waged a battle in the courts to prevent them from being deported to China. And the human rights organizations backed them up, arguing that if they were deported to China, they would merely be going from one prison camp to another and facing one situation in which their human rights were threatened to another situation in which their human rights were threatened, going from Guantanamo to the Chinese prisons. So they were under a rather unlikely deal that was reached. They were deported to Albania, which was the one country which agreed to take them. So the new lawsuit alleges that the CSRTs, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, relied on essentially the same evidence that was used to clear the five, that is to say the five who were released to Albania, and that the detainees who still remain at Guantanamo, continue to be held as a result of a political agreement between China and the U.S. Well, isn't that interesting? So, in other words, what they're arguing here is that those same Uyghurs who, a couple of years back, were released to Albania, essentially the evidence against them was identical to the evidence against the remaining remaining seven Uyghurs who continue to be at Guantanamo. And the reason that they weren't released is because the Chinese objected. The Chinese government, Beijing, objected. And they continue to be held at Guantanamo because if they were released to China, there would be a big human rights outcry. And but they don't want to release them to release them to Albania, apparently, because they've worked out a deal with the Chinese state. So essentially, China is using the U.S. military as a surrogate to keep these militants behind bars, despite the fact that they have been convicted of nothing and they have been charged with nothing aside from, being deemed, quote unquote, enemy combatants by the military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay, which are not recognized as legitimate by any government on earth except for our own. And I suppose the People's Republic of China. Isn't that a little irony? So, let's see. Also, Last week, when I was last on these airwaves, I was talking about the situation in Georgia and Ossetia and Abkhazia, about which perhaps we'll also have a little bit more to say. But that very same day, which would have been August 12th, there was another attack in Xinjiang. With the Olympics in Beijing in full course, three security officials were killed August 12th, last Tuesday night, at a roadblock 30 kilometers from Kashgar, Xinjiang. The official Chinese press agency Xinhua said the assailants jumped from a vehicle passing through a checkpoint and stabbed the agents. These were just some terrorists, said a local police officer from Yamanya, where the attack occurred. And a fourth official was wounded in Yamanya town, according to the new Chinese news agency. The assailants remain at large. Now, the news reports, even those from China, have actually been rather sketchy as to who these so-called security officials were exactly. Some accounts have, that's generally the phrase which is used, security officials or security agents, but it doesn't say what actual force they belong to. Some accounts have referred to them as border guards. Other accounts have referred to them as paramilitary police, which would imply that they're members of the so-called PAP, the People's Armed Police, which is the National Paramilitary Police Force of China, the one which was implicated in most of the rights abuses that we saw in Tibet earlier this year. But other accounts have actually called them private security officers. So presumably some kind of private security agency which has been contracted by the Chinese state. So once again, if that's the case, rather an irony for a supposedly socialist state, I would say. I'd like to find out more. Unfortunately, most of the press accounts have been rather sketchy, and I don't have a budget to go to Xinjiang. If somebody gave me a budget to go to Xinjiang, I would go to Xinjiang and get it all straightened out to the best of my capability. Let's see. Dilshat Rakhseet, a spokesman for the German-based World Uyghur Congress, said that the authorities in Kukcha have detained more than 90 people since the August 10th attack in that city, just 2 days earlier. This includes women, he wrote in an email, quoting local Uyghurs he had talked to by telephone. There have also been mass detentions in adjacent areas. So, okay, so since this wave of attack, there have been sweeps in which, well, this was a week ago, they were saying 90, and by now I believe it's well more than 100 Uyghurs have been detained by the security forces in China. And earlier this year, in the prelude to the Olympics, there were five Uyghurs were summarily executed, publicly hanged, on rather spurious charges, not of involvement in any terrorist attacks, actually, but of merely of being members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, the ETIM, merely being members. They were publicly hanged. It should be noted that the East Turkestan Islamic Movement is one of these sort of semi-apocryphal groups. It actually seems that it emerged perhaps 5 years ago, maybe a little bit more, as a sort of a bureaucratic shorthand by the Chinese authorities for a wide variety of small kind of autonomous cells in Xinjiang, which want independence from China and have been engaging in various actions, some armed, some merely agitation, as it were, and basically not under any, you know, organizational umbrella, but each with, you know, their own separate names and their own separate structure. And just as a sort of a shorthand, the Chinese authorities started referring to them as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, because most of them want an independent republic called East Turkestan in what is currently the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China. So it was sort of just, you know, its origins are very similar to Al-Qaeda, actually. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, Al-Qaeda was just, a small group of people around Osama bin Laden. And then the authorities in the United States started using it as a shorthand for all of these Islamic militants all over the place. Because of that, it took on a certain cachet. And now, you know, everybody wants to be Al-Qaeda. So now you've got Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in North Africa, Al-Qaeda here, Al-Qaeda there. You know, it's sort of the U.S. authorities made it cool to be a part of Al-Qaeda. And similarly, the Chinese authorities made it cool to be a part of the East Turkestan Islamic movement, the ETIM. So it's sort of a case of creating what you fear. It really did, it seems, turn into a single, you know, organized movement. What had been before a collection of small autonomous cells. And ironically, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, the U.S. State Department has claimed the ETIM as a terrorist group in a move which was fairly explicitly taken to win Chinese support for the Iraq invasion back when the U.S. was still trying to get some kind of United Nations fig leaf for their invasion of Iraq back in 2002. So let's keep going back. Okay, so 2 days earlier, 2 days before I was last on the radio, on August 10th, there was another attack. Chinese police shot and killed five people who hurled homemade bombs at a police station and the Office of Industry and Commerce in Kukcha, which is where the sweeps later were carried out and are still being carried out, I believe. Two police officers and a security guard were reportedly wounded in the attacks. Once again, the media accounts, even those from Xinhua and the new China news agency, that is to say the official Chinese sources, are very vague on exactly who these so-called security guards and police officers were. And once again, use of the term security guards indicates that they might have actually been sort of like, you know, rent-a-cops, Pinkertons, so to speak. Let's see. This took place in, once again, in Kukcha, an oasis city in the northern rim of the Taklimakan Desert, about halfway between Xinjiang's capital of Urumqi and Kashgar, where the attack took place the week before that. The separatist Turkestan Islamic Party days earlier issued a new videotape calling for local Uyghurs to avoid planes, buses, and trains during the Olympics. Chinese authorities say the group is based in Pakistan, where Uyghur militants are said to maintain training camps. The SITE intelligence group, that's S-I-T-E, which I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's one of these sort of, you know, Western, you know, right-wing national security wonk type, you know, jihad watch organizations. The SITE intelligence group, which monitors militant groups, said the six-minute video was in the Turkic language spoken by Uyghurs. "Choose your side," quote-unquote, said a masked, rifle-wielding man on the video. "Do not stay on the same bus, on the same train, on the same plane, or in the same building, or any place where the Chinese are." So once again, there seems to be a, here, let me go online and see what we can find out about the SITE intelligence group, which seems to, which seems to share with the authorities in Beijing a concern for the Uyghur separatist movement here. The SITE intelligence group. Let's see what it stands for. Let's see what they have to say about themselves. Studying the primary source propaganda, training manuals, and chatter of terrorists, offers insight into terrorists and their activities that cannot be obtained anywhere else. Failing to monitor terrorist propaganda is a failure of intelligence, blah, 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 blah. Does it say what SITE actually stands for? Let's see. You know, this does not appear to be readily apparent information. SITE intelligence group. Well, anyway, we understand where they're coming from. They certainly seem to be a bunch of, you know, right-wing security wonks. And they certainly seem to share the Chinese state's antipathy to the Uyghur struggle So that ought to be food for thought. Hmm? Let's see. Uyghurs outside China have been taking the opportunity of the Beijing Olympics to launch protests. In Turkey, a Uyghur man doused himself with petrol outside the Chinese embassy in Ankara and set himself on fire. Mehmet Dursan Uygur Turuk Oglu, 35, was rushed to the hospital where he was treated for second-degree burns. That would have been August 8th. That same day, an anonymous bomb threat to Air China's Tokyo office forced a passenger jet to make an emergency return to Japan. There was no claim that Uyghur militants were behind the attack. The tension resulted in heightened security measures in Xinjiang, with police shutting down the bazaar in Urumqi. Checkpoints on every major road in the province have resulted in long queues. And I understand that since then as well, Uyghur pilots in China have been grounded merely by virtue of their ethnicity. Uyghur pilots are not being allowed to fly in the internal commercial flights within China for the duration of the Olympics. Talk about ethnic profiling, eh? Chinese police have arrested 82 individuals for allegedly plotting an attack at the games. And then there were the public executions. And the police were last week carrying out house-to-house searches in the city of Guilia, or Yin Ying in Chinese. And Guilia, by the way, was the scene of a massacre February 5th, 1997, when the Chinese security forces opened fire on Uyghur protesters, leaving hundreds dead. And the massacre itself, it seems that up to 100 were killed, but that was just in the big massacre. Then there were, several days after that, there were smaller massacres and incidents of street fighting in which hundreds were killed. Back in February of 1997 in the city of Guilia, where once again people were local Uyghurs were protesting against the same sort of things which led to the protest which we saw in Tibet earlier this year. The fact that they are that their land is being massively colonized by Han Chinese settlers under official government policy, and that they are rapidly becoming a minority in their homeland. And all of the choice bureaucratic posts in the administration are going to Han Chinese, and the economy and exploitation of oil and natural resources is in the hands of Han Chinese bureaucrats, and the wealth which is being extracted is going to under the control of Beijing, and it's not being reinvested locally. And there are some reports that particularly young Uyghur women are being forcibly relocated. Now, according to one of the Uyghur human rights organizations, which was in the news just recently. Let's see if I can find that reference. Where they are actually saying that Uyghur women are being forcibly deported to work in Chinese factories. Now, I'm not sure that this has been corroborated exactly. Trying to find the account online. Okay, I'm going to have to look for it later. I'll play some more music and look for it later. But let's see what else we've got here. Okay, and then there was the initial attack on August 4th in Kashgar, which we did discuss 2 weeks ago. Which sort of sparked the wave of unrest which we've seen since then. So, and once again, that in turn had been sparked by the Chinese state upping the repression in the prelude to the Olympics and the summary executions which had been carried out and so on. All right, I'm going to play some more music. We've played all the Uyghur music. Maybe we'll play some more Uzbek music. And then I'm going to see if I can find that other news clip that I wanted to read. And then maybe we'll consider taking some phone calls. Oh, yeah, let's hear some Kyrgyz music. The Kyrgyz are also immediately across the Tian Shan Mountains from the Uyghurs. And in fact, the Kyrgyz are probably the other Turkic people who are closest ethnically to the Uyghurs. So let's hear some Kyrgyz music. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 17.
Ah
Okay, that was that last one we just heard was called the River Herlen, Mongolian. That's all the information which I can find out about it at the moment. And here, let's see if I can just do that little trick. No, can't get any more information about that cut, unfortunately. The one we heard before it, that was entitled The Nightingale by Ruslan Jumabayev from Kyrgyzstan. Actually recorded in Naryan Province, Kyrgyzstan. In the poetry and music of Central Asia, the nightingale is a recurring image, and the Kyrgyz solo instrument genre ku offers the perfect medium for creating a sound portrait of its voice. Here, Ruslan Jumabayev reproduces the sound of a nightingale in the free rhythm of a ku, giving a performance that is not so much virtuosic as descriptive or philosophical, quote, unquote. Okay, so I was poking around online. Now, once again, you know, I readily acknowledge that I'm just trying to understand the situation myself, okay? I haven't been there. I have not been to Xinjiang, much as I would like to go. Once again, if anybody's got a budget for me, I will travel there and give you a first-hand account. Meanwhile, I am left trying to piece together the situation as best I can from New York City. So while I was poking around online trying to find some information, I found a report from Xinhua saying all Uyghur pilots working normally in Xinjiang. All Uyghur pilots serving the country's airlines were working normally in China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and none had ever been relocated to work for other airlines outside the Northwest region. So, well, this is worded rather ambiguously, but I suppose what they mean is that there never were any Uyghur pilots flying outside of Xinjiang, like, say, on flights from Xinjiang to Beijing. Only on internal flights within Xinjiang, and that they have not been grounded. So this is refuting reports widespread reports which have been out on the wire services. Okay, now some of the some of these other allegations. Here's the allegation that I was looking at about women being forcibly relocated from Xinjiang. Okay, this was from a Reuters report. China's government is forcibly moving young women from the ethnic Uyghur minority from their homes in Xinjiang to factories in eastern China, a Uyghur activist told the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. Rabia Kadir, jailed for more than 5 years for championing the rights of the Muslim Uyghurs before being sent into exile in the United States, called for U.S. help in stopping a program she said had already removed more than 240,000 people, mostly women, from Xinjiang. The women face harsh treatment with 12-hour workdays and often see wages withheld for months. Many suspect that the Chinese government policy is to get them to marry majority Han Chinese in China's cities while resettling Han in traditional Uyghur lands, and therefore is part of a strategy of cultural extermination of the Uyghur peoples, as it were. Now, again, you know, I'm a little bit, I'm not sure how much of this is necessarily to be believed. I would like to know what the bureaucratic rationale is for forcibly moving young Chinese women to work in factories in the East. I would imagine it's a question of economic incentive under a certain degree of bureaucratic pressure rather than actually being forced, but I don't know. And I will note that Rabia Kadir, who is responsible for these statements, well, you know, she just earlier this year she met with George Bush at the White House. In fact, just in the prelude to the Olympics, as a matter of fact. And so she is definitely of the, let's see, what is the name of, What is the name of her organization? Let's see. Rabia Kadir is the most prominent human rights advocate and leader of the Uyghur people. Kadir, 60, is the mother of 11 children and a former laundress turned millionaire. My goodness, how did that happen? She spent 6 years in a Chinese prison for standing up to the authoritarian Chinese government. Before her arrest in 1999, she was a well-known Uyghur businesswoman, and at one time the seventh wealthiest individual in the People's Republic of China. This from the website of the Uyghur American Association. Ms. Kadir is a loving mother, a philanthropist, and a political activist. She built up and ran a multi-billion dollar trading company and a department store in Urumqi, capital of Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, formerly East Turkestan. She was passionate in helping the downtrodden Uyghurs, especially women and children. In order to educate Uyghur children from poor families, she opened free classes using space in her department store. She started the Thousand Mothers Movement in December 1997 to empower Uyghur women to start their own businesses. Ms. Kadir's philanthropic efforts were at first praised by the Chinese government. She was appointed a member of China's National People's Congress, as well as the Political Consultative Congress in 1992, and a member of China's delegation to the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women in 1995. Initially, Ms. Kadir hoped to improve the situation of the Uyghur people by working within the Chinese state system. She tried to persuade high-ranking Chinese officials, including China's president, to change their hardline repressive policies against the Uyghurs. Beijing's attitude towards Ms. Kadir changed when she criticized China's treatment of her people during a National People's Congress session in March 1997. In her speech, she demanded, that would have been, by the way, immediately after the Golja massacre, 1 month after the Golja massacre. In her speech, she demanded that the Chinese government honor the autonomy conferred on the Uyghur people and respect their human rights. She strongly criticized China's harsh crackdown on the Uyghur student demonstration, which had taken place a month earlier in Golja City. There you go. To punish Ms. Kadir for her disloyalty to the Chinese Communist Party, she was stripped of her membership in both the National People's Congress and the Political Consultative Congress and forbidden to travel abroad. Beijing also pressured her to divorce her dissident husband, Sadiq Ruzi, who had fled to the U.S. in 1996. In 1999, while on her way to meet a U.S. congressional delegation, Ms. Kadir was arrested and then sentenced to 8 years in prison for, quote, stealing state secrets, quote unquote. Ms. Kadir's case has been an international embarrassment for the Chinese government after Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch publicized her case and aggressively pursued her freedom. In 2000, Human Rights Watch awarded Ms. Kadir its highest human rights award. In 2004, Norway's Rafto Foundation awarded her the Rafto Award. Then on March 17th, 2005, 3 days before an official visit to Beijing by the U.S. Secretary of State, she was released from prison on medical grounds. Ms. Kadir has been actively campaigning for the human rights of the Uyghur people since her release. Despite Chinese government efforts to discredit her, Ms. Kadir remains the leader of the leader and mother of the Uyghur nation, in whom the Uyghur people have put their hopes for the future. So, let's see. All right, so I'm looking for her website or the website of her organization, because she, just in the immediate prelude to the Olympics, she became the first Uyghur leader to meet with George Bush at the White House. So, well, there you go. We're back to the great game, aren't we? How unfortunate that the so-called mother of the Uyghur nation is meeting with George Bush at the White House, and obviously has no criticism of the invasion of Iraq, the ongoing occupation of Iraq, a fundamental betrayal. We could say, certainly, of, any solidarity between the Iraqis and the Uyghurs, both of whom are occupied peoples. And but then at the same time that the U.S. seems to be attempting to play Radia Kadir for propaganda purposes against China, at the same time, there seems to be a convergence, a very strong convergence of U.S. and Chinese official interests in repressing the East Turkestan Islamic movement, the, shall we say, undomesticated Uyghur resistance. And in fact, apparently, according to the lawsuit which has been filed on behalf of these Uyghur detainees at Guantanamo, a deal has been cut between Washington and Beijing to keep these seven Uyghurs detained at Guantanamo rather than having them released to a third country. So, once again, a pretty fundamental betrayal. And, you know, we would like to think that, you know, once again, given that the ETIM, the East Timor, I'm sorry, the East Turkestan, Islamic movement is, it's not, it's uncertain the degree to which it, quote, it really exists, quote unquote, right? It's uncertain the degree to which it actually is a, you know, a single centralized organization as opposed to a convenient shorthand for, you know, what remains a rather fragmented movement. So we would like to believe that maybe there are elements within what could be called the East Turkestan Islamic movement who are not throwing bombs around and do not, you know, want to impose a sort of a Taliban state in Xinjiang. And just as they are not interested in playing ball with the U.S., and just as we're not interested in playing ball with Beijing, they're also not interested in playing ball with Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And I don't know if this faction exists. I don't know where they are. But I do know that if they do exist, I would like to know about them and loan them some solidarity. And loan them a voice here at WBAI, if nothing else. And, you know, meanwhile, I've been continued to be rather disheartened by everything which I'm reading about the situation in Georgia. You know, there was a very telling headline in the UK Guardian, something to the effect of, "This isn't a tale of Russian aggression, but of U.S. expansionism," with the obvious implication being that those two things are mutually exclusive. Zero-sum thinking. Now, in what sense does U.S. expansionism in the Caucasus, which is a fact, which is a simple fact, okay, the pipeline being built by a consortium which includes Chevron and British Petroleum is not U.S., but certainly, you know, Western, part of the, you know, the Western oil cartel. Concomitant with that, you know, this big push to bring Georgia into NATO. I mean, clearly, this is U.S. expansionism in the Caucasus. But does that mean that there isn't Russian aggression in the Caucasus when Russia is now occupying half of Georgia? I don't see how these two things are mutually exclusive. On the contrary, they fuel each other. And once again, it's unfortunate that the peoples of the region have been pitted against each other and have been forced to choose sides in a protection racket, with the Georgians lining up with the U.S. and the Ossetians and the Abkhazians lining up with the Russians and being pitted against each other. And similarly, everything which I'm reading from the left-wing press, like The Guardian, you know, is talking about Georgian attacks on Ossetians, Georgian ethnic attacks on Ossetians, which now that the smoke has cleared a little bit, it seems quite clear, really did happen. And thousands of ethnic Ossetians have taken refuge across the border in North Ossetia, which is in Russian territory. And likewise, just everything that I'm reading from the New York Times is just talking about Ossetian attacks on Georgians. And now that the smoke is cleared, it's quite obvious that that really did happen as well. And in fact, if you go to the websites of the human rights groups, if you go to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, and whatever criticisms you may have of them, particularly Amnesty International, really does tend to be fastidiously objective in cases like this. If you look at what they have to say, they're saying, yes, there have been attacks on both sides. There really have been Georgian attacks on ethnic Ossetians, and there really have been Ossetian attacks on ethnic Georgians. It's gone both ways. But unfortunately, you know, the only people out there who are calling it like it is are Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and groups like that. And the press, if you don't actually go directly to the websites of the human rights groups, and if you leave it to the press to try to, you know, interpret things for you, if you leave it to the media to try to mediate things, you're going to get a very, very one-sided picture. And if you read the U.S., if you read the U.K. Guardian, or, you know, even worse, I suppose, Workers' World, much worse, I haven't even bothered to look at that. I don't quite have the stomach for it yet. You know, I'm sure that you're just going to be getting this picture that, you know, as the headline said, this isn't about, this isn't the tale of Russian aggression, but of U.S. expansionism, and that all of the ethnic violence has been Georgians against Ossetians. On the contrary, if you, you know, just look to the New York Times, you know, you're only going to be reading about Ossetian ethnic violence against Georgians, and it's going to be overwhelmingly portrayed as unprovoked Russian aggression. And, you know, I just find it really disheartening. And the most disheartening thing about it is that, unfortunately, much of the left in the United States and in New York City, particularly from what I can glean from the phone calls, which I took last week, has been, you know, thoroughly caught up in the great game. Even though, you know, we're here in New York City, we should have, you know, be able to have a little bit of a more distanced and dispassionate view of the whole thing. It seems that we also seem to be completely caught up in the great game and allowing our own perceptions of the situation on the ground in Georgia and in Xinjiang and numerous other places we could name across the greater Caucasus, Central Asia region, to be completely shaped by the imperial power plays which are going on, rather than taking a single standard position in favor of human rights and self-determination. So it's 10 minutes after the hour. A couple of people are trying to call in. I've really got mixed feelings about taking phone calls. I have to say that I really do. You know, there's one person in particular. I know there's some people out there who seem to think that I have a responsibility to take listener phone calls, and it's all about listener phone calls. Well, you know, that's a point of view. You're entitled to it, but it's not the only point of view. It's not the single point of view among the listeners. And, in fact, there's one listener who frequently leaves messages on my voicemail. He never calls in live to the show. At least I don't believe that he ever has called in live. But he frequently leaves messages on my voicemail telling me how much he appreciates the show and urges me not to take listener phone calls because he thinks it's a waste of time. And a part of me agrees. But there's another part of me which is always drawn to take listener phone calls because it really makes me wonder, you know, who I'm talking to. And, you know, I mean, there are some of you who call my voicemail and give me feedback, whether positive, negative, or neutral, or mixed, or whatever. And there are some of you who, you know, occasionally write me a letter here at the station, which I really appreciate. And there are some of you send me email or leave comments on my website and, you know, show that you're paying attention, which is always really good and I really appreciate it. But it's not many who do that, you know, it's few and far between. So I always feel compelled to open up the lines to try to actually, you know, have a dialogue with the listeners and see what they think about what about the ideas which I'm throwing out there. Or else, you know, I sort of get this uneasy feeling that I'm just spewing into the void, you know. And who was it who said in a critique of avant-garde art that they don't believe in art which is only accessible to five people? Well, you know, am I doing radio which is only accessible to five people or only of interest to five people? Because sometimes it feels that way. So perhaps against my better judgment, we have 15 minutes remaining to us, and four people are trying to call in. So let's plunge into the unknown. But I want a dialogue, okay? I'm willing to listen to what you have to say. I'm going to restrain myself. I'm trying to not get upset, not get beside myself with angst, no matter what people say, okay? But I really appeal to people to, you know, engage in a dialogue and to show that you've, you know, actually thought about what I'm putting out there a little bit, and don't just give me a knee-jerk response of, you know, shouting slogans at me, because it's really boring and depressing. WBAI, you're on the air.
Why don't you grow up?
Okay, do you have anything else to say?
Your issues are non-issues.
Non-issues?
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, you haven't made a lick of sense yet tonight.
Okay, how do you feel I failed to make sense?
Well, from what you're talking about.
That says nothing.
Well, that's what you've been saying over the last 2 hours.
Okay. Well, then you're not giving me much of a critique here, you know? This is...
I'm telling you the truth. What do you want me to tell you? Not a lie?
What did I say that you take issue with?
I don't take issue with anything. I'm just saying...
Oh, well, okay, then you're not interested in the subject matter. If you're not interested in the subject matter... Turn off the radio, you know, maybe read a book, turn on the TV, do something else. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, Bill, I love you. I love everybody. What's wrong? Listen, you play music, it's beautiful, but it's an auditory sensibility rather than a human response exactly, because we don't know what's being said. Now, let me give an example. You talked about a nightingale, and you played string music. Wouldn't you think that the musicians of these different countries would put a nightingale into wind music like the song of a bird?
Oh, Monroe, take it up with the musicians, please. You know, if there's anybody out there who understands Kyrgyz or Uyghur or Mongol and can tell us what the musicians were singing about, please call in, because I share Monroe's curiosity. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio, please.
Just a second. Okay, this better?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to say that, you're criticizing everybody else for being inobjective and not really understanding the situation. Then you say the only people that really understand the situation are Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International.
I didn't say they were the only ones who really understand the situation. I said that they're the only ones who are taking an even-handed look at the ethnic violence which is happening in Georgia.
Okay, now how do you know that they're taking a truly even-handed look from your vantage point? Maybe you happen to agree with them, so you think they're even-handed.
Well, hang on a minute. Everybody, all of the media accounts, it's very clearly slanted. I mean, the New York Times is taking a pro-U.S. position and is only talking about the Georgian attacks on Ossetians. The U.K. Guardian, which is, coming from the left, is taking a clearly pro-Russian position, is only talking about Ossetian attacks on the, I'm sorry, is only talking about, God, I'm getting my characters confused myself. I need a scorecard here. The New York Times is taking a pro-U.S. position quite clearly, and it's only talking about Ossetian attacks on the Georgians. The U.K. Guardian is taking a clear pro-Russian position, is only talking about Georgian attacks on the Ossetians.
Okay, but
okay, now the they're actually citing, the New York Times report actually cited Human Rights Watch as saying that there were that there were widespread Ossetian attacks on Georgia. Well, that's true. But if you go to the Human Rights website itself, it's saying that there were both ways, that they have documented, they actually sent a team to South Ossetia, and they in fact documented that there have they witnessed refugees, people who had been displaced in ethnic attacks on both sides.
Isn't Georgia the way it is today? It's a product of the so-called Rose Revolution, and that strongly backed Saakashvili.
Saakashvili was put in power by the Rose Revolution, yes.
Right, and the Rose Revolution, in turn, was backed from the West. It was a very pro-Western and United States.
Right, what's your point?
Okay, and then you have, like, foundations in... like George Soros has a whole project.
Okay, what are we talking about George Soros? Hang on a minute. You're trying to, like, impugn Amnesty International with George Soros? What have they done to each other?
Rights Watch is one of the things that he's a big influence and funder of.
I'm not so sure about that. Well, perhaps Human Rights Watch, certainly not Amnesty International. I'm not sure about Human Rights Watch either. I'm really not sure about that. I don't think they get Soros money. I really don't think that they do. But in any event...
According to the Covert Action...
According to Covert Action. Why don't you give me a legitimate source? That's not a legitimate source.
Well, Covert Action Magazine is an entirely respected source. I don't have the article in front of me, but it was very well footnoted and documented from other sources. It wasn't just somebody making it up. Oh.
Okay, so in other words, Human Rights Watch just makes things up, but Covert Action is all documented.
I didn't say they just make things up. I'm saying that they're aligned with people like George Soros, who helped bring about the Rose Revolution.
All right, if you seem to be arbitrarily deciding here that Human Rights Watch is completely biased and nothing they say can be trusted, then why have they documented the Georgian attacks on Ossetians? If they're completely in the pocket of Saakashvili, why have they documented Georgian attacks on Ossetians?
Because I believe they're trying to sell an imperialist line to a skeptical audience, and they have to win that audience's confidence and make a show.
All right. Okay. All right. That sounds pretty far fetched to me, and it seems that this is an opinion which you have arrived at completely arbitrarily.
Well, I think it's the practice of a demagogue or demagogy in general. Let's not say a demagogue to win the confidence of an audience.
This is an arbitrary opinion. You're not giving me any facts to back it up. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes. So far, it's 3-0 in favor of you. My big lack is that some of these names of these places, I find very confusing. They're pretty new to the Western ear, my Western ear, and a bit more explication, of who and what and where, would help me follow your argument, which I found very cogent, and pretty comprehensive.
Well, I tried to make it as clear as possible.
Mm.
All right, I'll try to do better.
The music you play is marvelous, always, just about always. And that's my comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. WBAI, you're on the air. Oh, come on. Hello? Hello?
That Uyghur lady was wonderful, I mean, in the sense that all the things she did.
WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay.
This is Andrea.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay. Oh, Andrea, hi.
Yes. I'm going to make a comment. I'm definitely not going to try to join into, the whole subject because I actually just came in. But I'm going to make a comment.
I hope you caught the music, Andrea.
No, I missed it. I'll listen to the archive.
You definitely should. That was the best part of the show.
I will. I will. I absolutely will. But this is what I'm going to say to you, and because I see a side of you that maybe a lot of the listeners don't see, and it's a side that I really enjoy. You know, I enjoy your mind and your knowledge, and we share a lot of music. But
I knew there was a but coming.
No. This is a but that I just want you to just chew on. It's not a condemnation, but I want you to chew on this. Because I walked in just as you said, you know, people tell me I shouldn't take calls, and I am one of them. But you took the risk and you said, okay, can I please get, you know, people that want to have a dialogue. But the problem is that I think you're so, like, your armor is ready and you're so defensive and so impatient that even people that call respectfully and might say the most ridiculous thing, but at least they're being respectful. At least they're saying what they think they know. You get so impatient with them. And a dialogue doesn't necessarily always have to agree with what you say.
No, definitely not.
No, right. But I'm just saying that it's difficult to listen to your impatience
exasperation.
Yeah. With their seeming, you know, I hate to say it, it comes across like you think that they're really stupid. And that's hard. It's hard to have a dialogue with someone and to
harsh.
Enjoy their mind. No, Bill.
No, it is.
Because
it's harsh.
It's harsh because I see a side of you. When you and I talk, you don't make me feel that way. I've never felt that, you know, that you think I'm stupid. I've never felt you're impatient. But you don't show that side of yourself on the air.
And so
I sort of wonder, I hate to say this, almost like you invoke the abuse that you get, almost. No, I'm sorry. I hate to say because you're so impatient and so enraged with their, like, how could you say that? Well, I just have to go. And so you don't even let them sort of even respectfully say what they think they is right. And who knows? I mean, sometimes it's okay to agree to disagree, but at least they're doing what you ask, which is engaging you in a dialogue. You know what I'm saying? So a dialogue isn't always smooth and on the same page, and it's also hard to get people to hear what maybe you know more accurately if you say it with impatience. It sort of makes us feel like, well, gosh, it makes people afraid to have a dialogue with you. At least on the air. I'm not afraid to have a dialogue with you because you've never made me feel that way.
Right, not on the air either.
Right.
Right.
Well,
so
yeah.
I think that because you've never said anything which has exasperated me. You've never said anything which was, you know, just blatantly.
Well, I barely ever call. I mean, even when I call you, I'm talking about music or something.
Right. That's true. But even when we're talking,
I'm not even going to attempt to have any type of world conversation. No. But I'm not going to attempt because I actually, you know, I listen to you and I actually am more ignorant than I care to admit, which is why I listen to you and quite a few shows in BAI. I listen to learn. So if you're trying to share your knowledge, I'm just saying that it's easier to digest. It's easier to maybe bring people over to your side if you say with a bit more patience and a bit more like, well, I disagree, but don't get so angry if people get wrong information, because especially here in this country, it's easy to get wrong information. And I realize that there are ways to research and dig up and, you know, go on the internet and find stuff, but maybe not everyone knows that. Maybe, you know what I'm saying? So I'm
My problem is with people who have already got their minds made up and they are going to,
But you do too.
No, I don't.
Well,
no, I don't. No, I don't. I readily admit my ignorance.
Okay, well. Well, that's true. I have heard, yes. That's okay.
Yeah, man, I repeatedly said over the course of this show, you know, I haven't been to Xinjiang. I don't know firsthand what's going on there. I'm just trying to piece the situation together as best I can.
Right.
But a lot of people, you know, that's not their attitude. Their attitude is they already know exactly whose side they're on and they've already, you know, made up their minds about the situation and they're just going to, you know, just sort of arbitrarily decide what to believe.
Right. But I would also say that this country tends to breed that. It tends
yes,
to.
Yes, it does.
It really, come on. Now,
I agree.
You really know that. It
yes,
does,
yes,
it does.
It does. Of
yeah.
course,
so,
I agree.
It really breeds, okay, if you're not with us, then you're a terrorist. Or if you're, you know, this, then you're that. If you're black, then you're white. If you're not this, then you're that. It's sort of, it's, there's no gray in this, there's no, let's just both share some knowledge and agree to disagree and shake hands and go and have a beer. You know, this country doesn't cultivate that at all. It's either you're with us or you're against us. So, yeah, I mean, and I guess what I'm saying is that maybe you could learn to, okay, no, let me rephrase that. I think you would have more satisfying dialogue if you allow people to say what may seem like the most ridiculously asinine whatever, and then just be like, okay, well, you know, and because who is it that there's someone I listen to just let someone just go on, and they completely disagreed. I hate to say it. You know who is a master of that? Hugh Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
He will let people say the most ridiculous, and he lets them say it.
Yeah, well, that's why he's on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and why I'm on at midnight.
Well, but no. But you, I'm just saying, and I'm going to leave you with this because I don't want you to feel that if I'm, maybe this is a conversation we should have.
It's 1:30 anyway, so I got
to. Okay, yeah, you have to go. Anyway, I'm just saying that maybe if you learn to just listen to what you think is the most stupid stuff, it might be quite interesting to see how they come about that. And maybe if you're, something in your way might bring.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.